Well, good evening, and it's such a pleasure to be here in Madrid and in a country which has, for so many centuries, led in different forms of governance and in different forms of tolerance, of diversity, and of learning from history and moving forwards. This is a special country, and I'm particularly honoured to be here. Thank you all. So I opted tonight to speak about the weakening of democracy and the fracturing of global order, because in almost every continent of the world that I visit and travel to, I'm asked those two questions. Is democracy dead? Is it fatally wounded? And is international cooperation over? And what people are talking about is the extraordinary revolt against the elite in almost every democracy around the world that has been going on for the last 3 years at least. And then more recently, I think, the extremely unilateralist development of the United States policies under President Trump, which people fear is accelerating a demise of international cooperation as we see it. So that's my theme tonight. But what I'd like to do is to discuss why this is felt, but then to point to why actually this is an extraordinary opportunity, that this moment for our democracies to stop, to think, to renovate is a very important and powerful one. And likewise, this moment in international cooperation is a huge opportunity to stop and to think and to create an international cooperation which will better support democracy in individual countries. So that just gives you a little bit of a roadmap of where I'm going this evening. So let me start with the weakening of democracy and just remind you of, as it were, how we got to here. Because in 1990, in the early 1990s, we have to remember the euphoria that swept across the world, the sense that liberal democracy, that open free market policies had categorically won, that the Soviet Union and its former satellite states had lost, and that their demise proved that there was only one model that worked, and that was liberal democracy with open free market policies. And I think that spelt the beginning of a couple of decades of tremendous complacency in the democracies of the world. If there's one thing I think we can learn from the last couple of decades, it's that democracy is a project that all citizens have to engage in and keep renovating and building, and that those two decades of complacency ill-served our democracies. And that complacency, which had already begun to crumble a bit, was quite severely broken in 2008 with the financial crisis. Because what came with the financial crisis, and I saw the beginnings of this, not in Britain and in the United States, where the crisis began, nor even in the Eurozone, where it very quickly spread to, but all around the world in developing countries and in emerging economies, what I had been noticing was the number of countries that were no longer asking, how is this done in Europe, or how is this done in Britain, or how is this done in the United States, but instead were asking with great insistence, how is China doing this? How is Singapore doing this? In other words, the search for a new model had begun before 2008, but 2008 was a fracturing moment where suddenly the model that had been the victor seemed broken. And that break was seen most clearly from other countries who said, look, it's clearly a faulty model. And I was talking earlier today, my conversations with senior officials in China, I think, most clearly underscored that. where conversations before 2008 were often of a kind, we'd like to learn from Europe, we'd like to learn from Britain, from the United States, particularly about how to integrate into international organizations. After 2008, it became much more a reversal of perhaps you guys should be learning from us, because your model is clearly broken and doesn't work. It's led to tremendous damage. So that these are facts that everybody knows, but all I'm underscoring as a first point this evening is that that complacent model broke in 2008. It led to a really serious questioning around the world about both the wisdom of the way in which open free market policies had been pursued, for two reasons. One, because they seem not to have regulated the global expansion of international financial services adequately. And two, that when there was a crisis, the globalization that had taken place seemed to expedite it and make it global. So what might have been a containable banking crisis in two countries was instantly, within 6 months, global trade had practically seized up. So real questions about whether this was the pathway to go down. And if we look at the past 100 years and we look at 22 countries and financial crises in each of them, what we find is the one consistent pattern is that within the decade after a financial crisis, the rise of the far right, of the membership of the far right, of the electoral support of the far right goes up by about a third. And that's consistent. It's the one consistent effect of financial crises across the 22 countries that a team of German economists have looked at. And that is the other effect of 2008, of course. And that's the second thing I would say about where we've got to, and that's posing a real question over our democracies, is that quite a large number of people in this room, if I can presume that you're every bit as young as I am, or perhaps just a fraction older, is that we grew up in a world where there was an absolute expectation that our lives would get better. In 23 of the world's 25 richest countries, 50% of the population over the last decade have seen their income stagnate or decline. So the era of presuming that life will get better is over. And add to this the fact that human beings are much more sensitive to losing things than they are to winning things. Loss aversion is really powerful. That sense of loss has had a huge impact on politics around the world. And I underscore that because although we all see the data and we see the figures, there's nevertheless, in most countries, there's a disdain for what people are voting for. I see this in Britain. Oh, the people that voted for Brexit, they're just foolish because it's them that will lose their jobs when Brexit actually happens. In the United States, you know, the people that voted for Trump, they're idiots. They'll lose their jobs. Their lives will become... I don't think we can afford that disdain because those people have made a vote, and to me the vote is a very clear vote that they don't trust the establishment political parties to represent their interests and to make decisions which will ensure that their lives get better. It's as simple as that. If we look at the United States, child mortality, so for every 100,000 births in the United States, about 15 years ago, 11 babies died. Today, that number is 26. It's unheard of in a wealthy country for child mortality to increase like that. But it's a real indicator of what's happening in a health system when it becomes more and more dangerous, on average, for a woman to have a baby. Take the other statistic from the United States, the one that Angus Deighton, the prize-winning, Nobel Prize-winning economist, has highlighted. The life expectancy of white, non-Hispanic, middle-class Americans is now going down. Again, that's an extraordinary statistic in one of the world's wealthiest countries, where you would expect life expectancy to be going up, And for that demographic of white, non-Hispanic Americans, it's going down. And I stress the loss because it's not the case that it's the poorest Americans that voted for Trump, and it's not the case that the poorest Brits voted for Brexit. It's not the case that it's the poorest in each country, in Brazil, in the Philippines, in Poland, in Hungary, in Turkey. It's not the case that it's always the poorest who are voting in revolt. If we look at the United States, I love the words that Ali Hochschild uses in her fabulous book, Strangers in Their Own Land, where she describes middle-class white Americans who feel that they've been queuing up for a very long time for the American dream. They've been standing in a queue, waiting for their lives to get better. And then they began to feel that other people were jumping in on that queue. Women, blacks, minorities, immigrants, refugees. And so they revolted against it. And it's pointing to the sense of loss of status, the sense of loss of position, loss of entitlement, which is underscoring quite a lot of the revolt in the establishment. Now, should we worry? Is the revolt against the establishment something that should just wake us up and cause us to renovate our democracies? Or is it something that's going to weaken our democracies and make them fragile and easy for non-democratic forces to take over? That, to me, is the essence of the question. And I think we can see three things that successful populists are doing that tell us something quite important. And the first is their appeal to the concerns that actually people are feeling. It's their connection to the people, their use of the language that they represent the real people. Now, it's often not particularly authentic. I don't think anybody pretends that Donald Trump has spent most of his life as a construction worker. But his success and the success of the Brexiteers, who, you know, some of whom went to Eton and have now discovered, you know, the common man, as it were, their success is demonstrating to us how out of touch the establishment politicians seemed to voters. In Britain, it was, as it were, the elite, academics, politicians, civil servants, travelling around Britain and warning people that Brexit would cause a drop of 1.5% of GDP, that Brexit was a bad idea because the European Union could deliver good things, without ever stopping first to ask people, what do you care about? What are your priorities? Because Brexit, the European Union, and British GDP are nowhere in the top 10 priorities of the people that they were talking to and who were about to vote. And that deafness, the stopping of listening, the way politicians have come across from left to right to use PR companies to peddle, to do salesmanship, instead of stopping and actually listening and finding out, I think has been exposed by this revolt against the establishment. A second thing that the populists are doing very, very effectively is simple, direct messages. Simple, direct, often simplistic and false messages, but simple and direct messages. Not the politics of management consultancy speak, not the politics of pragmatism and incrementalism, not a message of vote for us because after the 1.5% GDP, we'll think about whether we can start investing more in public-private partnerships for infrastructure. Not that message at all, but simple, clear, direct messages. We will make sure that you get a job. We will make sure that nobody takes your job. Or across Europe, so sadly, a set of propositions which do not have evidence to back them, that it's immigrants that are taking your jobs, your house, your places in hospital, and we will stop the immigrant flows. So that speaking directly to what matters to people is a second lesson from the populists. And the third is that what they're bringing to politics shows up how much the last 30 years has been a politics, as Oakeshott, the political theorist, would say, of pragmatism and restraint. And that politics has always been equally imbued with and mobilized by a transformational message, a message of redemption, of salvation, as we're hearing, echoing, whether it's again in Brazil or in the Philippines or in the United Kingdom or in France. And that's got to actually, that has a mobilizing and energizing force. It can be for the bad, but it can also be for the good. And I point to those three things because I think populism has come for many elites to mean necessarily bad things. But those aren't three bad things. They're three things that the rest of the political establishment has to learn really fast, to listen to the electorate and to find an authentic way to represent what people care about, to speak very directly to what the electorate cares about, and to have some kind of transformational message to people who are scared and anxious and worried. Now, I asked you the question, when is it that weakens our democracy? And to me, that's very simple. When politicians are using those messages and then sidelining or deliberately damaging the core institutions of democracy, then we're in danger. And the two that I would single out are first the rule of law, where what we've seen among a number of the populist leaders that I've mentioned is a disregard for the rule of law, a desire to put down judges, to sidetrack judges, to sideline restraints on police power, to, in the name of expediency, to toss aside the rule of law and say, look, I'm just going to get things done. The extreme would be Bolsonaro in Brazil saying, I'm going to give every Brazilian a gun so they can defend themselves. Or President Trump, when he was campaigning, talking disdainfully about judges and their opinions and why they shouldn't be taken notice of. Even in Britain, the headlines of ministers disdaining the decisions of judges. This is dangerous for our democracies because it's only that rule of law system that permits us to run a system where every citizen is equal under the law. And the second, and this is more controversial, and it, I guess, is controversial in Spain, is the resort to so-called direct democracy. And the resort, now politics, we all live in representative democracies. And I just want you to pause for a minute and think about what that means. Most of the decisions governments make are very complicated decisions, or they're decisions which require very difficult trade-offs. Do I build a bridge in your town or your town? Do I use public money to support cancer drugs for the cancer that your father has or the cancer that your father has? Every decision has a loser and a winner, and governments have to make those decisions. And we elect representatives in the hope that they will make those decisions based on information which is more than any of us individually can gather. I think it weakens democracy that all across the world we're seeing leaders resort to referendums instead of consultation with their people. So my argument is that representative democracy has to involve genuine consultation with people, genuine listening to people, genuine engagement of citizens, and that a referendum is the opposite of all of those things. A referendum is a one-shot way for politicians not to take responsibility for a difficult decision. You can see that most clearly in the United Kingdom, where for party political reasons, it was going to be a difficult decision to decide what to do with the European Union, and so it was remitted to the people. Once the people vote, who do we hold responsible for the decision? You can't vote the people out. It's the core of our representative democracy that we elect people to make decisions, and they have to take responsibility for those decisions. And if they make the wrong decisions, we can vote them out. If we give away that principle, we give away the point of representative democracy. So even in Switzerland, the home of the referendum, the home of direct democracy, look at how it works. Direct democracy is not about referendums in Switzerland, right at the local level. It's a constant process of consultation. You can't build a playground without consulting everybody who's going to use that playground. And when they do have a national referendum, as they did on immigration policy, it's for the government to decide what the right thing to do for the country is. And in that case, the government went the opposite direction to the referendum result. And that's a government making a decision and taking responsibility for it, having taken the views of the population through the referendum. And I say all this because the world is genuinely confused about referendums, because all around the world people are saying, but surely that's democratic. It's giving people a voice. Look at how they're used in the United States. In the last presidential election in California, there were 51 balloted issues. That's 51 referendums. Every Californian voter had to make a decision on 51 different decisions. A professor at Berkeley pointed out that it would have taken him at least a decade to do the research to be able to vote intelligently on each of those 51 issues. And yet, people were being asked to do it in the polling booth right there on the day. That's not representative democracy. That's not people elected consciously to make decisions which will always cause winners and losers and to be held responsible for making that decision that creates winners and losers. So I think that the populist challenge to democracy, we have to be quite clear about. It's a challenge when it's threatening and eroding the rule of law on the grounds of expediency. And frankly, every government wants to do that, in my experience. There's always a moment when a government says, oh, to hell with all that procedure. I just want the police to go and grab those people. So let's just legislate. Let's lift the restraints that we've had without understanding the consequences for the way, for example, police officers every day carry out their jobs. So the arguments for expediency are always there. And it's for the citizens in a democracy and their elected representatives to hold on to the rule of law restraints that have taken several hundred years for countries to develop. And likewise, on referendums, in the end on this, and it's one of the few issues on which I side so comprehensively with Mrs. Thatcher, they are, she said, the instruments of dictators and demagogues. And what she intended by that was they're the instruments of people who don't want to be held to account for their own decisions, and therefore would like to claim that it's the people making the decision, and therefore they're not responsible. But I'd like to come back now to why I think this is a positive opportunity, because I think those are the perils of the populists. But if I come back to the three things that I talked about, those are the opportunities for people across the political spectrum to renovate democracy in each country. We are living in a very important moment where established political parties in most countries are collapsing. In Britain, the Conservative Party has a membership, the average age of which is 75. That's an extraordinary political party, right? The membership has an average age of 75. If you look at France, the last election showed that the main party of the centre-right since the end of the Second World War and the main party of the centre-left have collapsed. They're polling at 3 or 4% of the population. They've collapsed. In that country, it's opened up a space for a new kind of politics. And if we pause for a minute and think about what made Macron's campaign very successful, the first thing was the way in which he's actually taken on some of what the populists do. The first is listening and finding a voice which resonates with the population. So before Macron ever ran for office, he engaged in what was called La Grande Marche, which was a process of really surveying, sending people out to knock on doors across all of France to find out what people actually were worried about. What did they care about? What were they worried about? What did they think of politicians? What did they think of government? Not to campaign, but simply to listen and to feed the results back. if you think about the messages that Macron's campaign ran around, which were messages of renovation, of transformation, of bringing something new, of bringing people from outside of the system, of bringing a greater diversity of candidates, which was the flip side of which is saying to people, I get it. The political class do not represent you. They've been feathering their own nests, and I'm standing for something different. I'm going to bring a wholly new group of people into government and into office. Now, of course, he carefully picked a cabinet which is a mixture of people of different experience and frankly, different quality. But his message as a campaigner was a message of renewal and of transformation, which I think showed how it is that these populist lessons, as it were, can help us renovate democracy. But then there's the question of how democracies survive in a fracturing global order, and how it is that the populist revolt inside countries is going to ricochet into what many see as a period of anti-globalization, of turning back. And of course, we've been there before. In the 1890s, the world saw the fastest globalization ever, if you take immigration into account. And by 1914, it had come to a seized halt, so that we saw an absolute nationalist turning in through the 20s and 30s. And that's what people worry about in the present global order. And the lesson from the interwar years was that to prevent that happening, you need a leader, you need a hegemon, you need one country who's willing to set some rules and have everybody abide by them. And of course, in the post-war era, that's been the United States. But that United States leadership has been crumbling for some period. And I think in the last year, we would all accept that it's become suddenly, stridently more unilateralist. So if you think about, even in the last 4 weeks, the nuclear posture review that the Trump administration have unveiled, proposing that the United States use nuclear retaliation to non-nuclear threats, ripping up 40 years of non-proliferation. If you think about the Secretary of the Treasury at Davos talking about a weaker dollar as a positive thing so that the United States can trade more and sell more around the world, absolutely neglecting the consequences, not just for the United States, which needs a strong dollar so that other countries buy dollars and so that other countries buy treasuries, but also neglecting the fact that the United States has, for the last 60 years, supported a rule-based system on exchange rates where countries can't and don't, more or less, devalue to gain competitive advantage in trade. And then, of course, the Secretary of State announcing that it would be a great idea to revive the Monroe Doctrine, the doctrine whereby from 1823 onwards, the United States declared its primacy in Central and Latin America, a primacy it declared in the 19th century to tell Europeans to stay out of the American backyard. Rex Tillerson announced this as a response to China's encroachments, as he sees it, in Latin America. It turned out that his nostalgia for the Monroe Doctrine was not shared by anybody south of the South American border. And for good reason. Because for many of those countries, for Brazil, for Argentina, for Chile, for countries for whom China has become their main trading partner, China stands as a counterweight to American dominance. So it's precisely because of a Monroe Doctrine mentality that they are seeking those relations with China. Now, all this feels familiar to anyone that watched the early years of the Reagan administration, right? The unilateralism. Reagan came to office saying, we shouldn't have nuclear non-proliferation, we should go for nuclear supremacy. We shouldn't be part of these international organizations, we're giving too much to them and everybody else is just taking. We forget that Reagan came to office with powerful unilateralist talk, and it turned out to be just talk because he soon realized, and his administration soon realized, they needed to cooperate. Can we rely on that now with President Trump? I think not. Because in the 1980s, the Soviet Union was already on decline. And the United States was very clearly still the hegemon and very clearly still the master hand. Look at what happened when the United States withdrew from UNESCO. It withdrew and it became even more powerful in the organization that it was no longer a member of and not paying its dues to. Why? Because the organization desperately wanted to win back the United States' participation. But I would argue that we can't guarantee that. The United States has been shown not to be able to rely on that logic anymore. The first thing President Trump did, and a Democratic president would have done the same, was withdraw from the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So 12 countries around the Pacific coming together in this trade and investment partnership. It was assumed that if the United States withdrew, the partnership would collapse. What's happened? 4 weeks ago, the 11 remaining countries announced that they are going ahead without the United States. Second move was to withdraw the United States, or to announce that the United States would withdraw as soon as it is able to, from the Paris climate process. What's happened since the United States declared that? Every single country in the world has joined it. Every single country in the world has joined it. The United States is now the only country in the world that is not participating in the Paris Climate Treaty process. That's extraordinary. President Trump announced that he had great reservations about NATO. Maybe the United States should no longer be part of NATO. What did it do? It catalyzed Europeans into thinking about what a European security strategy would look like without the United States. And the development of those ideas caused the Secretary of Defense this last weekend to rebuke the European Union and say, no, you've got to do this within NATO. Suddenly the United States is feeling that maybe America first is America alone, that its unilateralist power to set the rules by which others cooperate is no longer anywhere near as strong as it was. So I'm not saying that it doesn't have the power to shape and fashion some areas of cooperation, but I'm saying it no longer has anywhere near the power it had. And that, to me, spells two very powerful opportunities. And the first is for other countries to come together and to make use of the institutions that America helped to build and led in building, to take forward cooperation on their own terms and to renovate those institutions to make cooperation work better. That's opportunity one. The second is to start reshaping international cooperation so that it deals much more squarely with international collective action problems. What do I mean by that? I mean the problems that unless countries cooperate, no individual country can make headway on. I say that because one of the side effects of cooperation under one leader was that the cooperation went into a depth that reflected US preferences. So you see that in each one of the institutions that the United States has led in the development of. So one of the institutions I know best, the International Monetary Fund, you saw it all over the crisis management being offered by the International Monetary Fund. It became most visible in 1997 when the East Asian financial crisis happened, and suddenly the United States was applying its own preferences and conditions to a program for Korea. So that even mainstream American economists were saying, this has lost you all your legitimacy as an international organization. So what I'm saying is, international organizations have perhaps too closely and deeply pursued American preferences instead of focusing on the tasks that all countries need them to do. And those tasks are sometimes less intrusive than some of what we've seen international organizations doing. In trade, for example, it does mean pulling back and thinking about what are the trade arrangements that all countries need in order to develop in the way that they want to develop. And I think it's that kind of cooperation which will mean pulling back from some things in international cooperation and much more vehemently pursuing others. A great grievance across Europe among the surveys that have been done is a sense that globalization has globalized the opportunities of the world's global companies, but has not globalized any of the responsibilities of those same companies. And nowhere is that clearer than in tax, where companies that have had huge opportunities to go global have done so without governments nimbly adjusting their own ability to tax and regulate those same companies. So the new international cooperation could begin to really focus on an issue like tax where no one country can do it without cooperation from other countries, without losing hugely. And it's that international cooperation which will better to support the democracies in which people are now railing against globalization and against the elite. Because it's that kind of international cooperation that I think will support renovated democracy in countries around the world. Now, I'll stop there so we can have a conversation, but thank you all for listening.